Ladies and gentlemen, madams, messieurs, welcome to Bit Podcast, the name of the channel. At the end of the day is the name of the show. I'm your host, Jason Marinchuk, and I am joined today by author, Blaze commentator and host, and tapper of signs, Mr. Oren McIntyre. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, man.
Thank you for being here. Tapper of the signs, maybe some people don't know, you have a few bangers out there. It's the Simpsons meme. One of my favorites is it's really not rocket science. These people are evil and they just want to diddle your kids. There's the other one about the journalists, which is, I'm going to paraphrase here, correct me where I'm wrong, but you think you hate journalists enough, but you don't, or something to that effect. I got a sign. You inspired me to do a sign as well. My sign is what we're going to be talking a lot about today is, you know, don't make me type the sign. You don't live in a civilization anymore. Now that, when I started saying that about a few months ago, raised a few eyebrows. People don't like hearing that. Although I think the evidence is now all around us. I mean, it's kind of hard to deny now that you have planes falling from the sky, bridges collapsing because they got nudged by a ship. Ships were just running out of power. and now people setting themselves on fire in front of Trump legal hearings and a whole bunch of other stuff. I feel like I don't need to qualify this anymore. But one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you about this, Oren, is that you, sir, are one of the better voices on Nick Land. And part of this concept that I'm calling civilizational capital relies on Nick Land's concept, both of capital escape and of this idea that competency is that capital is a derivative or result of competency, where humans do something competent, they produce excess, and that essentially is capital that can be invested. When we take that from the material to the non-material realms as well, to the metaphysical, we can get into some funky little waters. But before you do all that, Oren, you have a few announcements. I know you have a book coming out. Let us start with that. And then any first thoughts on Nick Land and capital escape? Maybe if you could tell people, give them as brief a synopsis as possible with Land. I know that's a tough one, but
yeah, it's always exciting to try to break down Nick Land into bite-sized pieces. But
we have an hour, so yeah. go ahead.
I've got a book coming out called The Total State. I certainly talk about Nick Land among other thinkers in there. And I think a decent amount of what we're going to talk about here is part of that book. I think some of the things you're talking about also fit into my overall thesis of why we find ourselves increasingly in a total state. And so that book's going to be coming out on May 7th. The Capital Escape is really just Nick Land's observation that capital tends to develop its own interests. This is not new to him. This is something obviously that goes all the way back to Marxian analysis and beforehand, which is, you know, natural because Land was a Marxist before he made his travel to the right. But one of the things that he notes is that capital gains its efficiency basically by liberating itself from the people it was originally intended to serve. As people who maybe have a more right-wing orientation, we could probably recognize this in a way that we don't like when it comes to the globalization of businesses that originally were created for the interests of bettering the lives, providing a product to, creating jobs for, and ultimately serving a particular community with a particular way of being, a particular culture. It's grounded in the substrate of a particular group. And so the capital is bound. It's territorialized inside the needs and the desires of a particular set of people. But over time, capital always finds out that it will be more efficient if it can remove itself from different aspects. It's limited. The consumption and production is tied to the specific limiting factors of people. And so it's constantly seeking to deterritorialize itself from different aspects of the particular and reterritorialize itself in things that are more general and things that can, cross over different cultures, people groups, communities. And we see this in the desire of corporations to homogenize their product. It's not just for the United States anymore. It's not just for England anymore. Your product needs to speak to all peoples, all religions, all races, all everything. That you, nothing can be for a specific group of people. The slogan of every company is our product is for everyone, whether it's Warhammer 40K now, you know, it's got to be for everybody. Dungeons and Dragons, doesn't matter how, you know, nerdy and specific and unattainable, unreachable that product was originally, it has to appeal to the broadest base in order to go ahead and raise its efficiency. And so the capital escape is really just the acknowledgement that anything, any of this excess, the surplus that we produce, eventually the organizations and the structures producing it find that the best way to continue to produce that surplus is to basically unhook it from the civilization it was originally attached to in the first place. And this creates a great problem for civilizations that want to bank that capital for themselves. It ultimately produces bad incentives for both the civilizations and the capital.
Yeah. Dimes said something recently when he was talking to Matt Erickson over at Kingpilled, and he said that people actually don't want happiness. Companies are always trying to sell happiness, and people actually don't want happiness. They'll settle for it, or they might get convinced that that's what they want. But I think to my own add-on to that is that people are constantly looking for meaning. René Girard once said that the true universal desire of mankind is for transcendence. We are always trying to transcend ourselves into something greater than ourselves. You know, the ideal, you know, all ideologies are based on ideal. They're both based on both an assumption and the ideal. And as we're trying to maximize or move towards the ideal, that's what, you know, we can get ourselves very pigheaded and think that this is all there is. You know, this is the cure. This is the ultimate way, state of being. The bitter white pill here is that we're not designed for it in that way. We have structures, we have mechanisms that allow for transcendence through religion and through the church, but if you're trying to do it artificially, you find out that all you end up creating is mush. I was really struck by this. I was in the bigger town. I'm living in Western Australia, and I was looking at all these taverns, all these bars, and they're all the same, like mimetically copied the same. Like, you know, they're just slightly different decor on, you know, someone's with slightly different geographical locations, but it's the same products, the same vibe, the same everything. And you kind of look at this and you're like, why? You know, they're all selling the same product. And that's kind of what I feel like this, as you're saying, with this sort of unbound capital into when you start creating this globalization where it's a product for everybody, it becomes a product for nobody, and it becomes pointless, meaningless. And as it becomes more and more meaningless, I think the competency that is required for capital to exist in the first place begins to decrease, to the point now where people just are doing shit work. And bad shit's happening, and we're caught in a position where we don't know how we reverse trend.
Yeah, there's this constant problem in that you need to make things more efficient, to make them scale up, to massify them. You need to make them less organic. You have to, again, remove them from the particular, and you need to homogenize them so you can create that universal applicability. But as you do that, you create a simulation. This is why so many people go into we live in a simulation. Everything is so unreal. And that's because basically every part of your existence has been removed from its organic context so that it can be streamlined and optimized and, you know, managed to its, the most productive output. But that eventually erodes your basic human existence. Like you said, it removes you from any ability to interact with the transcendent. It hollows out every experience. Everything that was once sacred has been sold back to you as a product to be maximized, and the quality necessarily has to go down, even though the efficiency is going up. And So what you end up is with a bunch of people, human capital, that has been degraded to the point where it can't maintain the civilization that it was, turned into an artificial gray goo in order to go ahead and facilitate. And so, like you said, we're seeing kind of the results of that now. It's the beginning of that generation, that generational handoff. As much as people love to bag on the boomers, they were the last ones with probably a truly organic culture, some true connection to what it meant to be, just a human existing in a normal social setting. And so they have also a lot of the drive and the competency attached to that more organic and real existence. And as they try to hand that off to generations that were raised in a completely artificial and degraded environment, you're finding that people not only don't have the ability, they simply don't have the will to maintain the systems that allowed the system to get to where we are.
See, I'm looking at both as a conceptual issue and an investment issue, because I think what's at key here is that it's not so much that we lack competency, is that the competency we have is too dispersed, and it's being put into weird places. Like, you have a bunch of young men who could be doing something, beneficial for civilization, but playing video games all day, or girls on OnlyFans. We can look at the symptoms, but the actual cause comes back down to that idea that you don't live in a civilization anymore. That if we assume that, we start from zero. The movement up to one then becomes, okay, how do we harness this competency, and how do we create this capital, and where do we invest it? On a conceptual level, what I've been dealing with is this idea that civilizations have, let's say, three main domains: the social, the economic, and the political. And we use these terms anyways. They're kind of hollowed out terms, social capital, political capital, economic capital. We can understand is just the economy. But when we talk about social and political, it's kind of it's a buzzword. It's kind of like, what is this thing, right? Quite often, I think it means like some sort of power, like, political power is political capital. The ability to get things done kind of is that vagueness. But when you think about it in terms of competency, then that certainly gives it meaning. Like how these things are and what they do, then becomes a bit more clear. What I would say is that what's important in the civilization is you have these three domains, and they're sort of surrounded by a regio, meaning both region, ruler, and religion. And you need those three things in order to keep those domains together and working harmoniously. As that regio is weakened or destroyed, what ends up happening is those three domains begin to attack each other and begin to cannibalize each other for their capital, for their competency that each one of those domains can produce. And we can start seeing those effects where, people are putting the economy, let's say, as the most important thing. Well, if you do that, then all of a sudden you have infinite immigrants, because we're dealing with very corrupt, stupid people who just don't care. They have a zero time preference. They've entered what I call a primal frame, where everything is immediate, everything's existential, and tomorrow is just tomorrow. We'll deal with tomorrow when tomorrow comes. You can't run a civilization like that. So that's a lot of stuff to throw at you. But I think, again, I think these things are starting to become more and more self-evident.
Yeah. What aspect of that do you want to, there's a lot there. What do you want to discuss? There's about 15 directions we could go there. So
yeah, I know. Let's talk about the regio for a second. Region, ruler, religion. I have something here about religion that we can get into. I know we share different faiths, but I think this can harmonize something. We've certainly seen this sort of, I'll put it like this way. One of my predictions that's coming true more and more is I've called it the Jason's apple pie prediction, which I say the woke is not going to be put away. This might be of interest. It's not so much the woke is going to be put away. It's going to be transformed. It's going to be transformed into what I'm calling the neo-trads. It's going to be transformed into, OnlyFans girls wearing frocks and headscarves baking apple pies. and they're going to return to something sort of like a mush Christianity, or create a mush Christianity in order to facilitate that. Because what they're actually looking for is redemption, and they can't find it in any ideology that they currently have. So you're going to see more and more of this. It's sort of this, the left wants to return to 1995. The right wants to return to 1955. You're going to find something in between. This goes down to, you know, Sweeney's tits, which is very 1995. You know, a lot of, now I'm starting to see headscarf stuff all over Twitter. This is part of that trend. So it's like, you're going to have all the wokeism there, but it's going to have a new facade. So think Dave Rubin, sensible gay men wearing sweater vests, buying children, which will be okay now. You know, they even right-wing evangelicals will be like, well, you know, is he Jewish? Like, it's fine, you know? So I'm saying all this to kind of tie it into that Reggio idea of like this. What I'm concerned about is that I think there's going to be this attempt of revitalization. But what they're revitalizing is going to be half measures, because they don't really want real deal Christianity.
Yeah.
They want enough Christianity to look good, you know?
Yeah. I think what you're pointing out is simply the phenomenon of conservatism, right? Which is always a return to something that is far more radical than the actual, you know, past. The conservatives believe that, you know, MLK is the real right wing, you know, he's the real conservative, when MLK hated you. He was very clear about that, and was in no way conservative, be it economically, politically, racially, in any of these things. But the conservative job is always to kind of, you know, fight for the last revolution. Say, no, that was far enough, and that's where we should be, while pretending like you're going back to the core. This is a lot of my problem. I just did a stream today on kind of the showdown between Rufo and Yarvin, and while I think that Rufo scores a lot of points against Yarvin in that debate, ultimately I think he loses, because Yarvin makes the pretty correct point that Rufo isn't fighting for a return to the founding. He's not even fighting for a return to the 1950s. The 1950s are too reactionary for Rufo. He can't go that far back, much less a return to the founding principles of the United States. People who call themselves classical liberals, they would never survive in a classically liberal society. John Locke would have struck all these, you know, horrible Reddit atheists from, you know, public life. They don't believe any of these things. They're all pretending like they're returning to some principle, but that principle has already been revolutionized many times over. And so, yeah, I think you're right that you're going to see this. You're going to see people, oh, I've got headscarf on, or I've got some kind of trad signifier of Christianity, but it's only attempts to move slightly backwards into a concept that's already been so thoroughly revolutionized that they wouldn't recognize the real thing if it hit them upside the head.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you're seeing this, you know, I'm an Orthodox Christian, or observing, I should say, and which is neither here nor there. But one of the things you keep seeing is, as I get further into Orthodoxy, is just how little people actually understand about Christianity, and how, you know, I was a Chris Hitchens atheist for a long time. And really a lot of their critique is valid when you look at a lot of the churches they are critiquing. You know, even down to the Roman Catholics to a certain degree. It's like they've completely failed at the mission, because they've replaced this mission with asses in the seats, or asses in pews, rather than the continuation of the Gospels, like of the teachings of Christ. And what oftentimes that does is, you know, Father Turbo Quayles once said that, you know, a lot of right wingers get attracted to Orthodoxy. They get in because they think, oh, you guys are against all the people I'm against, until they get into the church and find out actually the problem, that one of the things that the church is against is me.
Right.
That I'm a problem, and I got to fix this problem. And suddenly people don't want to do that anymore. And I think that's kind of the concern I have with what this neo-trad movement is, that it will pacify a lot of people. A lot of people start thinking that they've won. We're winning. know, Donald Trump's in office and everyone's wearing headscarves and it's looking very delightfully 1955 again. You can, you know, say the N-word and a whole bunch of other stuff. But ultimately, we're still going to be on the outs. You know, if you're dissident, you're still too hardcore. You're still too revolutionary. You're still too a little bit too fringy, and need to be kept over there because you're in some ways, I think it'll be much more aggressive, because suddenly now we're a rival. You know, we're occupying that same space and we're presenting a model. We're presenting a way of being that is not going to jive with that mush Christianity or that sort of neo-trad kind of veneer. And I think, you know, if we'll almost miss the days of wokeism because that's, you know, they kind of need us around to as a scapegoat. Once it moves into neo-trads, and then it'll be more of a, we need to get rid of these people kind of thing.
I think it's wise to always fear containment, to always fear, you know, the system, you know, just processing you and putting you inside of its constellation. I think that's always something to be aware of. And especially as people who are on the outer edges of the right, it makes perfect sense because you've seen this happen so many times, right? This has been captured and controlled so many times. You know, how many times has there been a revolution inside the Republican Party? Oh man, the Tea Party, it's coming. You know, it's only a matter of time. I will say this, and you know, I could just be blind because maybe this has been something I've been inside of. You know, so I'm completely willing to admit the possibility of my own blindness to this, just because of where I'm at in this particular scenario. But I will say that if you tried to explain to people a couple years ago that Curtis Yarvin would be on Tucker Carlson and Charlie Kirk, that a mainstream outlets like the Lotus Eaters or the Blaze would be talking to people like Nima Parvini or me, if you tried to explain to people that, you know, a lot of the ideas and the things that we are talking about now in mainstream, you know, the Great Replacement is something that just everyday pundits would talk about. I think they would think you're insane. Like, try to explain that not to someone, you know, from 10 years ago. Try to explain that to someone from 3 years ago. I think they would be like, yeah, okay, right, sure. And so I don't want to say that this means that these problems are solved or like, oh yeah, victory is inevitable. No, not even close. But I do think we are seeing a interaction with the right-wing vanguard by the mainstream in a way that we have never seen it before. I think there's a lot of reasons for that, but one of them is simply that the base has broken loose because of Trump. And Trump has all kinds of flaws, deeply flawed guy, deeply unworthy of the movement, I think, that he inherited. But this he deserves credit for, that he shattered the Overton window on the right. The right is no longer, the GOP is not a party anymore. It isn't. It's a loose collection of people desperately trying to contain Trump and the people who supported him. And I think that there is we have a moment here where we're probably closer to people being able to actually explore things on the right in a way that they just have not previously. So I don't. Again, I think it's wise to always fear containment and capture, but I'm not super black-pilled on the idea that all of this is just going to get all this energy is just going to get sucked back up again. I think we are actually at a moment where, you know, maybe only because things have gotten so bad that the mainstream has to listen to people on the vanguard for the first time in a long time.
I think they've run out of ideas. There's no more. There's nothing new being created. You know, wokeism, I think, was onboarded so aggressively because it was new, you know, both pro and anti. It was like, you know, Yarvin talks about that sort of that energy, right? Like all of a sudden there's like new stuff to consume and put out there and have reaction, you know, reactions to. And they, you know, for 10 years now, they've been, you know, using that for squeezing that rock pretty much dry. And now they're at the end of things where there is no new ideas. Everything feels a bit bleh, it's boring. And now pivoting to, you know, the waters we swim in is exciting for a lot of these folks. Like they're coming, it's hard to, you have to remember back to the first time, you know, you encounter some of these ideas and all of a sudden it's like, oh, right. Like that's what they're feeling, that sudden surge of new and forbidden and ooh, spooky. And ooh, you know, who's this Evola guy? He was a fascist. Ooh, he's Italian though. You know, he's not German, so he's probably safe. So, you know, don't be like Arvin, read the French as well. But yeah, I get that excitement. I think that, as always in all these kind of things, as these ideas become kind of centralized, they're going to start having to become a bit more mushy as well, because people are not going to be able to onboard everything. And they're going to try to, again, not try to sacrifice any part of their identity or their life in order to incorporate these ideas. They're going to try to fit these ideas, smush them in wherever they can so that they can essentially have the same old life, but just with, you know, with elite theory kind of stapled on the, on their doors kind of thing. So yeah, it's going to be interesting. I agree with you that, yeah, living in a world where Yarvin's on Tucker is a wild and wacky world, man. Like I was glued to it. And I was like, what's going on? Yeah, we'll see. We'll see where these ideas go. I think they're certainly worthy of it. I just think there's also this need to say, okay, and then what? Whereas if we're generating these ideas, mm-hmm. and now suddenly there's 50% of the population of the West, let's just say, young men especially, who are onboarded to even the most basic dissident right kind of concepts, that leads us with the question of, okay, and then what do we do with these people? Because quite often they think it's just like, well, we make more shows.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, okay.
Infinite content generation. You know, I think it's important for people, and maybe, you know, for the nothing ever happens crowd, maybe this does nothing for them, but I think we really are in a moment, I think a apocalypse type shift is going to happen here. I think we really are in a moment where we have reached a limit for a number of systems that are central to our current way of life. However, I don't think anyone ever sees across those horizons. I think we all want to blow by a blow. Oh, well, here's how the world changes in 10 steps. Well, okay. You know, nobody gets that. Sorry. Like anything you see about that is always a post hoc, you know, way to try to fit events into your frame. That's never something people actually lay out when these kind of things are happening. And so that doesn't mean that, you know, there is certainly a danger of everyone just sitting around and making an infinite number of podcasts and not doing anything of value. But I also think people who, you know, people are right to say that Yarvin is not explicit. You know, his theories often just rely on a certain amount of like miracle to happen, like collapse happens or the elites suddenly realize they need the dark elves and all of a sudden the entire world shifts. People are right to say that to some extent. But at the same time, it's also like, well, how many serious, like truly transformational events are just laid out in a plan somewhere by some guy? Very rarely. Right. You know, the world historical events are things that are in motion. You know, they're and Yarvin's not a man of action, so he won't be the guy to carry it out either way, right? But the idea that everyone needs to have this like giant playbook of how we shift paradigms it just doesn't seem to gel with history for me. I think there are a lot of things that people can be doing. I think that, you know, as boring as it is, like becoming worthy and bettering yourself and your community, building these stronger ties, creating networks that are organic and real are the things that are going to matter. It's not as sexy as the idea that you're going to, you know, rewrite the Constitution into some super based monarchy that's going to, you know, fix everything. But it's probably a far more realistic thing for 99% of people to actually focus on. The truth is, if you actually believe in elite theory, the answer for most people is, become virtuous enough to be led and to produce and be led by a better class of elites. That's the actual answer for the vast majority of people.
Which may not be a bad strat either. the only thing is it's putting all the it's putting all your hopes and all your capital into, you know, someone else's basket and hoping that they don't drop it. What I'm looking at, I don't want to bore you with these concepts. By the way, I see the chat going off. Thank you very much for tuning in. If you have any questions, if you want to have asked or in anything, send us a super chat. We'll read them out at the end of the show. We'll make sure make some time for that. And I appreciate each and every one of you. So what led me to the civilizational capital concept was originally watching, and maybe you probably saw this, it was making the rounds a few months ago, of the it was a video of a woman in Congo trying to cross a river on these like two flimsy sticks of wood. She fell in the river. And the caption was, "The world has failed Congo." And I was like, no, I don't think the world's failed Congo. I don't think Congo's failed Congo. I think this woman is a representation of 10,000 years of living in the Congo. And that from a civilizational frame, this is intolerable. But from a what I'm calling a primal frame, this is how you do business, right? Now, there might be a very good reason for it. I came up with the example, and this is a hypothetical, but the idea that, okay, someone built a bridge out of wood. They've obviously galvanized. They've taken parts of that wood to go do other stuff with, or it's broken and fled, washed away, and there was no one there to build to fix it. But the concept behind it might be like, well, that river only flows, you know, like that for 3 months out of the year. The rest of the time is just, you know, just traverse it like normal. So we don't allocate resources to building a permanent bridge because we can use it for other stuff. And if you send a UNESCO team in there from a civilizational frame who then goes and builds a brick bridge, you turn your back and you come back a little bit later and you find that they've used the bricks to do something else with. And you're like, what are you doing? Like, why don't you leave a bridge there? And like, they're like, because the bridge doesn't belong here. It's a conceptual issue that, so when you're introducing this primal frame into a civilization, it begins to destroy the civilization itself. The issue is not so much the immigrants that are being let in. It's that they're in a frame that doesn't jive with an idea of like maintaining and building something for generations. Their idea is like, no, you build mud huts because mud huts are cheap and you just live that way. And what do? Well, you eat, fuck, produce children. Like they're just in that cycle. It's not a good or bad. It's not a right or wrong. It's just an is that you have to deal with. And that, so this idea with civilization is one, you can't let in people with a primal frame in. And I think that, and this isn't even racial, you know, there's lots of white blue haired kids who are very primal right now who are just letting things deteriorate and burn because part of this framing is that they have a zero time preference. Everything's immediate. Everything's existential. Every crisis has to be dealt with because if you don't, you're dead. So they're freaking out. Everyone's just freaking out all the time. So you can't build from that. Like there's no way to invest this competency. When Matt started doing the PayPal Mafia stuff and we started diving into that, it's like, now here's a group of people who are very civilizational minded and who are trying to, I think in some ways, deal with this competency crisis because it directly affects their business. And when you start looking at what they're doing, like building these new, like we will call them future cities. There's different terms for them. One of the big ones is in Honduras, it was called Prospera. And you hear Trump saying he wants to build freedom cities. This is civilizational capital. This is a civilizational capital project, not term that, but they're doing these things. These things are happening. Mm-hmm. So for any naysayers out there who think this is all crazy talk, it's like, no, this is, I'm just showing you. And I'm trying to formalize a term that you can use because I think what we can do to your point, Oren, is we can start buying up towns. We can start taking the fringe. You know, the things that are overlooked. You can go buy abandoned steel towns, mining towns out there for like, I think it's like $2 million. Like cheap. So it's not impossible. It's not crazy. And one of the things that I think instead of just hoping and wishing for the good Caesar to come, Well, okay, if the idea is that we have to become righteous people in order to have a righteous king, start becoming righteous people, you know, by producing capital and investing it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'll go ahead and spoil my book for everybody. You know, still go buy it, guys. But here's the last chapter.
I'm gonna buy it
since we're talking about it being relevant. The only way out is through this, and the only way through this is recognizing how to do exactly what you're talking about. The total state arises because we dissolve every familial community bond in order to offload all of those dependencies onto a centralized state, which then uses that to control us. That's why we're here. People can't imagine educating their children. They can't imagine taking care of their elderly parents. They can't imagine, you know, being in charge of the safety of the people around them. And so they offload all of that power onto the state, and the inability to maintain small scale networks is what allows the state to grow. One of the most powerful things I read a couple of years ago was The Ancient City. And Fustel Kalange talks about the transitions in the religions of Indo-European peoples, especially Rome and Greece. And during that, he talks about how, you know, originally the religion of Rome is one of ancestor worship. We think of the pantheon of gods, but originally it's one of ancestor worship. And this is where the ideas of things like property rights come from in those societies. It's not the idea of mobile capital that you could sell for a profit. The reason you have property rights is that's where your ancestors were buried. And if you didn't continue to own the land they were buried on, you couldn't care for them in the afterlife. They would die, or another death, basically. They would starve and go hungry in the afterlife because you weren't on the land their bones were interred in. That's why property rights existed. And the idea that you would sell that off to someone would be insane. Like, you would be dooming these ancestors. And so the time preference arises from understanding a duty to community. It's having a particular people with a particular tradition that you invest into. That's what creates that civilizational capital. And so if we are going to rehabilitate ourselves, we've atrophied our ability to maintain civilization because we have allowed this outsourcing of all of these duties and dependencies to other sources. We have to go ahead and become the people who are able to once again weave those kind of overlapping circles of social responsibility back together. And so what does that start with? Well, to start with, you have to have people who are willing to make that sacrifice. So you have to get together with a community of people who share that moral vision, who share that willingness to have that burden of responsibility and to, you know, go ahead and form those communities. So like you said, buying up towns, concentrating, that has to be the case. I think that will occur naturally because I think our states, especially in the United States, because of our federal nature, are going to self-sort. It's already started. My state of Florida has gone from a purple state trending blue to a deep red state in just a couple of years. And the reason was really simple: COVID, right? Like the policies and the decisions there forced people to move. You had to consolidate your beliefs into a particular state in order to protect your way of life. If you wanted to go to church and you wanted to keep your business open, you couldn't do it in another state anymore. You had to move. And so I think we're going to see that facilitated. I think that we're going to, you know, we technology has allowed us to basically ignore the values of our neighbors for a very long time. And the ability to do that is quickly collapsing around us. And I think that will that'll happen naturally, but I think the intentional stuff that you're talking about is the much better option, because that's going to build social capital much more rapidly than the just hoping that kind of this natural sort will get us there first.
Yeah, there's a lot of bitter white pills that are going to be coming more down the pipe. You know, COVID revealed something. I've been saying competency crisis for a while now. I'm not the only one, obviously, but. With COVID, when you had those lockdowns and the sort of the reopening that happened, and you started seeing how people didn't know how to reopen. Like, you shut down this automatic processing, especially in shipping. Shipping had just been doing this thing, right? And shipping just did this thing, and everyone, it was almost became magical, right? Like, this is something I'll say about civilization. I think when it's done right, it actually does automate itself. That the person reflects the civilization reflects the person. These things become almost a paradox. When COVID happened and all those lockdowns happened, you suddenly started seeing that these processes, like, there was no one left who knew how this thing worked. So they had to scramble and figure these things out. Ever since I've been talking about all this stuff, I've gotten tons of DMs of people who, you know, I'll be careful how I say this because a lot of this is, you know, not for public consumption, but let's put it this way. There are critical businesses, you know, big ones, where their entire safety division, for example, is like three guys.
Yeah.
And two of them are retiring. We're seeing those Boeing where half their almost two thirds of their engineering core have taken early retirement because of inflation. They're like, oh, this is going to cost us money, so we're out. Contract us. You know, in a business that relies on engineers, like, pretty heavily. So we're going to start seeing this more and more. And for the people who say, well, you can't do this because these guys are going to stop you, or they're going to do this, they're going to do that. I'm like, with whom? Like, right. You have to understand this. Like,
yeah,
they're going to be dealing with so many freaking problems. Like, trust me, some weirdos buying up a town is going to be the least of their freaking problems. You know, it's a bitter white pill, but the resistance against us, even though it might be intensifying right now temporarily, is going to fade away because there's just going to be no one left to defend the regime.
One of the weird things that people do with the competency crisis is they pretend it won't impact the rulers.
Right.
It's very strange. Like, they'll say things like, oh yeah, no, things are coming apart. Cause I get exactly the same messages you're talking about all the time. It's terrifying. Like, yeah, I'm one of two guys who knows how to run this nuclear plant. Like, and it's over after.
Yeah.
Like, I get that kind of message all the time.
Dude, I'm not telling anyone to stop, but at the same time, man, like, it's like, I sometimes don't click on certain things until midday. Cause I'm like, I can't deal with this the first thing in the morning. Like,
not right now. I need at least three cups of coffee before I read about this decline in civilization.
And some tequila. Fuck that.
Yeah. but yeah, this is the thing that people do. And I get it. Like, it right now, it feels, because we are so dependent on artificial systems, it feels like the regime is just omnipotent, right? Like, they can reach into your bank account with a button, and they can, you know, shut down your ability to have a job. And yeah, my life can be destroyed, blah, blah, blah. You watch all these, you know, J6 protesters getting 12 years in jail for standing around with a MAGA hat on. And it feels like this is just, oh, the state can drop this hammer on you at any time. But you're exactly right. Like, this is already fading. The ability to do this is already fading. The U.S. military can't recruit people. The FBI and CIA and all these people are dropping standards left and right because they can't find anybody who will apply to what they do except a Mormon. You know, like, that those are the only bit that they're now all Mormon organizations because those are the only people who aren't on drugs and completely destroyed all the time. And so, you know, that's where they're at right now. And this is only going to dwindle. You know, I think of, for instance, Afroforum, you know, in South Africa, and my buddy Conscious Caracal, Ernst, they're putting together this alternative society, and they hear this all the time, right? Like, well, eventually they'll come for you, right? Like, you know, they're building technical schools, and they're filling potholes, and they're creating, you know, neighborhood watches, and they're basically doing what a government does, right? They're just doing it at a small scale for particular people, and they have a higher degree of competency because of that. And everybody who's involved, the kind of people who are involved, and so their network is just much more contained. And, you know, people are always like, well, eventually the government will come for it. It's like, well, maybe, but my government's terrible at doing everything else it does. It's so incompetent that we have to do this now. So am I going to bet on my people, or am I going to bet on the incompetent government? And also, what's the alternative, right? In the meantime, what do you do? Because the life that we're living in this scenario is much better than if this didn't exist. So even if they do come for this tomorrow, at least we lived a better life up until that point. And if they can't come for this, And if other people do this and the regime loses more and more power because the competency inside these small communities is just way higher and people would rather be governed by them than be governed by, you know, this Leviathan that's decrepit and dying, well, then that's a victory too. Like there are plenty of examples throughout history of empires who didn't get some official notice that the empire fell apart. It just, the regions became, you know, more powerful. The central government lost its competency and the elites that were good at what they did stopped moving into the capital and started running things in their own region. And that's how things came apart. It's a very old story. And there's no reason not to believe that we might see exactly that phenomenon here.
Absolutely. You know, it's the cure for blackpilling. Because even if you think this is all collapsing, it's like, okay, well, if it collapses tomorrow, you're going to have to rebuild it. Like, you're going to have to rebuild something. Like, where are you going to live? What are you going to do? Right? Like, you might as well start with these things now and making positive steps in order to stop being so vulnerable to a regime that is obviously, I mean, all the things, right? Corrupt, stupid, evil, you know, trying to diddle your kids, all the things, tapping all the signs all at once, right? All the signs everywhere. Just move forward, you know. If the big bad Jews come over and kick over your sandcastle, right? Build a new sandcastle, or pick your group, pick your tribe, pick your scapegoat, whatever you prefer. You know, I'm operating now on the assumption that these people just don't matter. And if I can't outthink this clown show, then I don't deserve to live in a civilization either. You know, like if they can outthink me, then, well, I should just, you know, call it a day and go wash toilets or something. I don't know, whatever job they ascribe to me. Oren, we're coming up in the last 10 minutes. Pitch your book. Tell us about the book. Tell us where we can find the book, how we can purchase the book. And everyone who's listening to the show should go buy the book. The book, of course, is The Total State, coming out May the 7th. Please pitch away.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's going to be at most big bookstores, Barnes & Noble and that kind of stuff. But the easiest way is probably to just pre-order it on Amazon. Total State is basically the story of my political journey. I think like a lot of people, I was a super normie-con talk radio guy for all of my life. I worked in politics. I worked in journalism. And yet I still didn't see many of the things that we're talking about now. You know, about 2016, things started to look a little weird. I was like, okay, what's up with this Trump guy? Why is it so important to get rid of him? But, you know, over time, I started to see the shifts in that, especially as I worked as a journalist, and I saw kind of how the sausage got made in a lot of stories. But when 2020 happened, like a lot of people, I was like, okay, you know, the churches are shut down. The strip clubs are open. You know, no one's allowed to go outside, you know, and earn a living, but, you know, Democrats, you know, and their foot soldiers are allowed to riot through the streets and drink champagne. What's going on? You know, the Constitution obviously is not stopping this stuff. And so like a lot of people, I started falling down the rabbit hole of many people that people listen to you are probably familiar with, like Curtis Yarvin and Nick Land. And they led me to, you know, reading lists of, you know, Bertrand de Juvenal and James Burnham. And as I went on this journey, I started to discover, even though I had not meant to do this, that all these different people I were writing about had like different parts of the elephant. You know, they had different pieces of a phenomenon that corresponds with a lot of what we're talking about how the total state is formed, how these bonds that of community that restricted the scope of government are slowly dissolved, both for our own personal social interests and for the interests of power, and how those things interact and how they also fed into the managerial revolution that James Burnham talked about and the rise of the managerial class and the mass man, and how this has gone far beyond our national borders and has gone global, and why that system seems to continue to perpetuate itself and travel a very particular path. This is why the woke won't be put away, by the way, is because it's actually central to the expansion of managerial power. And so, you know, I kind of trace that and try to lay out a reason why, you know, economically, socially, spiritually, and along the lines of political power, this revolution has all pushed in the same direction. Across a bunch of different thinkers, from Yarvin to Carl Schmitt to Vilfredo Pareto to C.S. Lewis to Alasdair MacIntyre, and eventually I try to give us some solutions, many of the ones we talked about here, about the need to go ahead and build strong, virtuous communities, because ultimately the rise of the total state is the story of the disassembling of virtuous communities. That's ultimately how it's formed, is by breaking down the incredibly important social capital that we're talking about and globalizing it and homogenizing it in a way that's destructive to human beings. And the only way to fight that is to create the kind of communities that are built up from the things that we're talking about.
I think it's a must read. I'm excited about it. So we will be picking that up. It'll be coming out in obviously written form. Any plans on an audiobook anytime soon? Because I know my listeners do audio.
Yeah, no, it should be. It's going to be coming out in audiobook. It's a the publishers sell off the audiobook rights, and right. Then if the book does well enough, I've been told that it's doing well enough to where we're going to get one probably no matter what. But then people have asked me, are you reading it? Because I do all of my voiceovers for my show and everything and my videos. And the answer is, I don't know. You actually have to audition for your own book. It's a very awkward and strange process. So I'm not sure when that will come out and if I will be reading it, but likely there will be an audio book of it.
Sounds good, man. Anything else you want to pitch or plug? I mean, I don't know if I purposely sometimes don't do the whole tell the audience about yourself, because I figure at this point, if you're tuning into a show with Orrin MacIntyre, you probably know who Orrin MacIntyre is. And if you don't, well, you're going to find out over the course of an hour and go check your things out. But please let the people know where they can get a hold of you.
Sure. Yeah, I've got the YouTube channel. I'm on Blaze TV. I have the podcast Orrin MacIntyre Show. You can get that on all your favorite podcast platforms. And then I'm on Twitter, I'm on Gab, I'm on Instagram, basically all the places you'd expect you can probably find my work, and so people can definitely follow me there, Substack, that kind of stuff.
We'll end with this question here with Stan the Storm saying, speaking of civilizational capital, does Hillary Clinton producing her own Broadway musical a sign of civilizational bankruptcy? This is the first I'm hearing about this. It's certainly a sign of something. Just a klepto craziness. I don't know. A new money laundering scheme. This is going to replace the Hunter Biden paintings thing now. It's going to be Hillary Clinton doing Broadway musicals.
Yeah, the Clinton Foundation is under too much scrutiny, so maybe you can just do it that. I mean, that's kind of what the Obamas have done, right? They got Netflix deals to make stuff that no one cares about, right? Right. That's the way you launder all this stuff through politicians, and I just happened to become a multimedia empire the minute I stepped out of office. I wrote a book and got 1,000 speaking engagements and started producing movies, and I'm sure none of that has anything to do with the favors that I made happen while I was in office.
Of course not. It's just meritocracy. That's just how things go.
I prefer the Romans. They just turned over a province to you. Okay. Yeah, you were consul, and now you just get to raid all of Gaul and take all of the stuff out of it. Get as many
Tuscany. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's graft for sure, but it was a far more honest version of it. Everyone could see the direct connections. We didn't have to do this stupid shell game.
Plus, I mean, what would Hillary Clinton Broadway musical be? Does it be Cats, but it's called Cunts? I don't know what Hillary Clinton just belted it out. Sun will come out tomorrow. I don't know.
I mean, nothing could be worse than Hamilton. So.
I avoided it. I purposely was I remember when everyone was going crazy about it. I'm like, nope.
No, I was a history teacher when it came out, so there was no avoiding it, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I wasn't, I mean, for even from a historical point of view, whatever. I mean, it was so obvious. And besides, I always look at who's applauding it. What's the quote from Rick and Morty? I don't care about your booze because I see what makes you clap. And all the people who are championing this, I'm like, I don't like any of you people. So if you like it, I don't like it. It's a pretty easy mathematical equation nowadays.
Yeah, there's a moment, and Christopher Hitchens was a loathsome human being, but the one moment I loved him more than anything else was when he was on The Daily Show, and he just called Jon Stewart's audience a bunch of like mooing cows, because that was a fantastic moment.
Well, we might get you back on. I'm going to be talking to Dave Distributist on Tuesday, but I'm planning on doing a Chris Hitchens Friend or Fed, possibly in April, and I'd like to maybe get you back on to do that one, because I think he's an interesting figure. You know, you have the, of course, the atheist stuff, and you have some of the contentious stuff with his support for the Second Iraq War, but then, you know, his hatred for the Clintons, and, you know, by saying that women aren't funny, which is just true, women aren't funny. So, you know, he runs a gambit, and I feel like there's a conversation we can be having in that gambit, in that spectrum.
Strange strange moments of baseness sprinkled in a bunch of cringe. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and it's obviously he affects things. It's like Jordan Peterson. You can love him or hate him or have whatever thing you want about it. But the Sons of Peterson, as Cyprian likes to say, is it's a movement. I think actually a lot of that is what's going to be the backbone to this neo-trad stuff. Is a lot of guys are going to start looking more like Peterson, cleaning your room, you know, and being good little mush Christians. So we'll see how that turns out. But anyways, I just want to have that officially logged. You and AA have your dialectic. I'm proposing a trinity here, a trinity solution, which is just, you know, no, you're both right, but I'm more writer, where it's going to be woke, but it's just going to look different and be presented differently. And you'll see a lot of right wingers jump on board, and then you'll eventually start seeing even left wing wingers like Bill Maher and some of that flip a switch and become sort of this mushy trad thing that kind of solves some problems and doesn't require anything from them, and hooray, you know, we're back, we've won nothing, but it's what's the old line, is that what's better than winning the gold at the Special Olympics? Not being retarded. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Thank you, Oren, again, for giving us your time. If you want to stick around, Oren, just we'll do a little vamping at the end. And we will see you all again soon, if I can get my brand up.